This is Richard Tarnas, March 13th, 2015, entitled Humanity's Rite of Passage. This is the Q&A portion only. There's an hour and 10 minutes of talk in the main file. This goes on for 45 minutes. This was delivered at the George Center for Community. It was sponsored by Rite of Passage Journeys and Antioch University Seattle with the Jung Society.
Okay, that's all I'll say for now, and then we'll please come up, Randy, and we'll go from there. Let me begin with, Randy reminded me, I was saying that the notion of the first axial era, or of the axial era, it wasn't thought of as first or second, it was the axial era, came from Carl Jaspers. What is it? It's the origin and goal of history, or that came out in the later 40s. And it gives me an excuse to mention what I think is one of the most useful and important works of scholarship that have come out in the last few years is by the late Robert Bellah. It's spelled B-E-L-L-A-H, Robert Bellah. And after he wrote it for his last 14 years of his life and then published it in his 80s. And it's called Religion in Human Evolution. Religion in Human Evolution. He was from the Paleolithic to the Axial Era is the subtitle. Harvard University Press, 2011. Great, great book. It's a big one, but it's a multidisciplinary masterpiece that many, many scholars are being influenced by. My entire faculty read it and with thrilled, and it's very seminal. Okay, so what an active dialogue was going on amongst all of you. I told Randy, I don't know if we want to stop this. I mean, but it's nice to collect together again. And I'd love to hear any thoughts, comments, questions, and so forth. And before we end, I do want to say something about heroic communities, which I think this is, and the crucial significance of such communities in this critical period. But I'll save that for towards the end. Any thoughts, comments, questions, please?
In our group, I was listening to some of my elders and hearing their anxiety about if there is hope, if this change can come about.
I think having that anxiety is it's completely realistic. In some way, it feels like it's too late for us in a certain way. Things have gone too far. They could have been turned around 20 years ago and weren't. Still, things can be turned around, and in some respects, that will be very life-enhancing if they can be. But I don't think there are grounds particularly for a kind of disenchanted rational optimism. But I think there are grounds for hope in the sense of hope being different than optimism. It's a theological virtue in a sense. It rests on more than our reason or our direct observation can necessarily give us grounds for. It rests on some deeper sense of larger benevolence and intentionalities that we may have seen at work in our own lives when we were most sure that they didn't exist. And yet, not to get too, you know, like sermon-like, but there is something about that individual spiritual experience of grace that if it is something that happens to individuals, it's hard to think that the interests of the Godhead stop there. I'm not saying that we're going to see the flourishing of human civilization and the species of the earth in the form that we in our current form would like to see if we could have our druthers. We're all going to die individually. That we can be pretty sure of. And it's possible that whole ways of life, certainly already whole species are dying. I have a, you know, certain sense of confidence in, well, I have a deep sense of confidence in the cosmos's creativity. And the creativity is always, that's the mystery of like the scarab coming out of the dung heap and signaling the rebirth of the sun out of the deep night. That experience, which so many people have had, that is so central to the initiatory mystery, I have faith that the fate of the earth is also in the same hands. I can't say it will necessarily retain everything that I personally would like to see it retain, but I know that I've lost things this lifetime. Sure that my life would be irrevocably impoverished because I've lost that, whatever it might have been. And yet, as a result of absorbing that loss, gifts came that could never have come otherwise. Anyway, that's the best I can say. Please wait in the back.
I was thinking about the night journey and the trip to the underworld and the shamanic disillusion, dismemberment process. And often in those cases, there's a fall into psychosis. It's irretrievable at times, and then there can be, if the psyche can withhold the ordeal, come out of that situation and bring the gift back to the community. And so we were talking in our group that are we in a state of psychosis right now? That could be. That seems really likely. And also, I mean, on an individual level, how do, that would translate into the collective, how would, how do we avoid psychosis on a collective level while bearing witness to the tremendous tragedies that we are facing?
Yeah, that's a great question. One thing I didn't mention, but I can, it gives me a chance to point out, like part of the descent, and it is a kind of creative descent that I think we're going through, involves the facing of insanity, of a kind of madness. It's the loss of existential certainty, including your very sense of what is the nature of reality. And in that sense, you could say that Nietzsche and like Virginia Woolf, they're kind of like paradigm figures of the postmodern descent into madness. And eco-psychologists have pointed out the madness of our civilization. It is a kind of psychosis. This total dissociation from the matrix of our being, the suicidal impulse, the suppressed depression that we're acting out through a manic inflation, et cetera. And I think the radical psychiatry movement, where people like R.D. Lang and others were pointing out that the insane person is in some ways the only sane person because they're opting out of the insane society that is running the show. I think it's very helpful to have a paradigm in mind, drawing from depth psychology. I think the work of Stan Grof is extremely helpful here. He and Christina, his wife, coined the term spiritual emergency. I think you could read a book of theirs called The Stormy Search for Self. There's also an anthology called Spiritual Emergency that a number of people contributed to. But it's the idea that the kind of deconstruction of personality, of reality perception and testing that happens in psychosis is often a profound process of consciousness transformation that permits a kind of psycho-spiritual rebirth that is profound, and that if in fact you look at a lot of conventional secular psychiatric literature, they talk about the different founders of religion, like the Buddha or Jesus and others, as being, you know, whatever, ambulatory schizophrenics and so forth. Freudian's called Jung that. And Jung himself, you know, felt that he was losing his sanity when in that 1913 to 1918 period that the Red Book came out of. And all of his work came out of that time period, all of his insights, etc. And he not only felt it overwhelming him, he also invited it. It was he sensed that there was a treasure there. He sensed that there was something worth risking everything for. So that's part of the death rebirth process. Is in fact an encounter with madness or insanity. Those people who do work with entheogens or psychedelic therapy or you know, ayahuasca, LSD, etc., often have to face a very powerful experience like that. And it's because you know, Tim Leary did not do the greatest job of preparing a whole generation to do those kinds of experiences. You know, you're just whatever, at an acid test or something like that, there's going to be a certain number of people who are experiencing things like that who have had no preparation for it. They don't have a shaman, a guide. Albert Hoffman, who who invented LSD, said once when we had a conference on psychedelics at Esalen, and he said, you know, the whole reason it caused there's such a reaction against LSD, and it caused, in a way, a kind of social catastrophe at the same time as it seeded the whole 60s countercultural revolution. Many of us wouldn't be in this room if psychedelics hadn't transformed the consciousness of thousands and thousands of people, especially many of the leaders of the 60s kind of consciousness revolution. But Albert Hoffman said, we did not, as a civilization, have adequate structures of sacred ritual that could provide an appropriate container for that powerful a medicine. While all these societies, like the, you know, in Africa and South America or North America, et cetera, have for millennia been using very powerful vision plants and psychedelic medicines, psychoactive substances. And having that kind of experience is pretty much par for the course at a certain level of depth of transformation. And yet that's where it's only really when you let go that the great healing can take place. If you're in control, you can't have the same kind of healing as if you that you can get if you let go, including of your very sense of what's real and your sense of identity, which is connected to your sense of what's real. That's where insanity lies. But when people take it and they don't have a context for it, and then they're locked into their fears, they're in a panic, and they get Thorazine or brought into an institution or hospital. I mean, also they get locked into it and they have flashbacks. They don't work it through. As Stan says, it's the full experience of the negative emotion. It's the funeral pyre of that emotion. That's the only way through it is through it and not suppressing it. So I mean, how many of our great artists, our great spiritual leaders have gone through that kind of experience? Meher Baba, you know, the different, you know, mystics, etc. So, yes, I think collectively we are going through something like that, and it's an essential part of that descent, that loss, that deconstruction of the old identity and reality, which is necessary for everything to become whole again on another level. There's a beautiful song by, of all people, Steely Dan, called Any Major Dude. Any major dude will tell you when everything's falling apart, and the demon's knocking at the door, the next morning it won't be there anymore. Everything will come together in another way. The Grateful Dead have a lot of songs about that too. Ripple and the whole second half of the whole American Beauty album has many spiritual depths in that. Anyway, those are a few thoughts about it. Thank you. Please.
I've been thinking about this in our small conversation, and you mentioned North America, South America, and Africa, sort of south of the Sahara there with that piece of... But when you mentioned at the beginning of your talk, sort of the whole axial age, none of those places were part of that axial age. It was sort of Europe and the Mediterranean and Asia and maybe Africa north of the Sahara. And it all the way out through Asia. So I'm kind of curious if there's some relationship there. That was my question. I was like, well, I don't know. What, nowadays, when we talk about rites of passage, we go to the North American, South American, and African cultures.
Or Aboriginal.
Aboriginal in Australia, right, another place that wasn't part of the axial thing. So there seems to be a conversation there in terms of this cycle. I think those cultures, from my experience, I work in programming for rites of passage, and so there's lots of stuff written, and we had a chance to actually work with some elders from Native North America and Polynesia. And, you know, to read the discoverers and the explorers from the axial cultures who then encountered these worlds, they were like children looking it up at us in awe, right, from those reports. We were the gods or whatever. Our...
Right.
But now you go meet those elders, and they look at us like we're the children.
Yes.
And so they kind of nod, and if we were to say, like, yes, our modern Western culture is going through a rite of passage, they'd be like, yes, you are adolescents, and you're burning down the whole world because you need to go through a rite of passage that we've already figured out.
Yes. Yeah. Everything that you say is I agree with, and of course, Europe and Russia and China, India, they all had primal before the axial revolution took place. They also, you know, the shamanic and indigenous and primal cultures were very widespread there as well. And there's been attempts to retrieve that. Ralph Metzner on the European, old European wisdom cultures, and of course in Siberia it's still there, etc. There are ways in which the axial-related cultures that then particularly coming out of Greece and Israel created modernity have developed... Yes, there's certain ways in which this whole evolution puts us... We're the young kids who are like... we're like adolescents compared to the ones who are thinking seven generations hence. You know, the initiated, many people have pointed out how much we our culture, not having initiatory rituals, means nobody's come into maturity. Where it's they're nations of adolescence. Just watch, you know, most of our blockbuster movies or commercials during the Super Bowl, if that's a time, and you get a sense for just how adolescent the culture is. It's being run by adolescents rather than adults. Everybody's thinking of the short-term bottom line rather than many generations into the future. So in that way, don't we look like an inflated three-year-old or adolescent, narcissistic, et cetera, short-term thinking, compared to the primal wisdom of the of those cultures? And that's not the whole story. And there's been, for example, the whole axial and modern developments also have a moral dimension that is very real. The urge for universal benevolence and the respect and dignity of all human beings, and the urge to minimize the suffering of others in a universal way, and to have one's developing knowledge serve the improvement of all human beings' lives, and certain elements of egalitarian social justice, even feminism, breaking out of social roles that are not just part of the way things have always been, but instead are giving each girl and boy, man and woman, an opportunity to individuate in a unique way. The urge to have a tolerance of many worldviews and not feel that one needs to negate the tribe across the river because they have a different belief system, or because they're not even human. We don't want to idealize any. I mean, there's great wisdom as well as shadow in every stage. And what I'm pointing to now is that part of the nobility of the postmodern is the radical opening to pluralism, multiplicity, and our need to listen to the wisdom traditions coming from many sources, including not the non-human, you know, the more than human, how much we can learn from trees, how much we can learn from whales. So I think the awakening to the wisdom of these of the cultures that have been suppressed, negated, marginalized, and even lost in history is part of the necessary movement towards wholeness and health that we need to go through as a civilization. Anyway, that's a few thoughts in relationship to your question. It's a very, very good one and comment. Please, and then you, and was there anybody else that's had their hand up for a while? And please, okay, so we'll do those three, and then we'll see what our time is.
I'm just curious, you bring up, you've talked about nature a lot, obviously, because we are, in fact, in it. It's a part of this whole discussion tonight. But in going through this process to kind of get back to where we're actually coming from, it's kind of the idea. Is it how necessary is it, do you believe, and to what degree, for us to really have we as in people, those of us here and all of humanity, truly raw and open natural experiences, like actually in the outdoors, not just intellectual, not just philosophical or spiritual, but to actually be in, realize how significant but insignificant we are, like actually in the natural world. Is this a crucial part of the rite of passage? Because in a lot of shamanistic traditions, there's the igloo out in the tundra or whatever. Is this absolutely a part of that, collectively?
I can't say collectively how we're all going to have that experience in the igloo. I know that in my own journey, it was definitely me alone in, I don't even want to say like in nature. I mean, it was the Big Sur wilderness, but we are nature, of course, too. We're a form of nature that's done a very unusual thing. And it was also using sacred medicine, which played a huge role for me all during, you know, in the years of my kind of, formation. I'm always being formed as I go down the stairs. You ask a good question about, like, where do you go to, like, the wilderness? Where can you go where you're not going to hear a 747 flying overhead deep in the Sierras or whatever? It's and yet there is still. Just in my backyard, I watch carefully and learn from the squirrels, the lizards, the amphibians, like the little newts and salamanders, and I look and I see those little salamanders and newts. They're tetrapods. They've got arms and legs that bend just the way ours do. And the way we move is because our common ancestor came out of the sea and developed those limbs and those lungs. And they're my brothers and sisters, you know, as I'm looking at them. So that encounter with the wisdom of and the tremendous evolutionary project and mystery of Earth's evolution is available in my own little backyard. It's just the consciousness that one brings to whatever little postage stamp we've got available to us. But you guys here, as I in California, you've got just within, you know, a short drive, incredible opportunities for engagement with the depths of nature. And hopefully much more will be recovered and restored as a result of our taking in its richness. Who did I say was next? Yeah, you and then you, yes.
You talked a lot about the axial age and this second axial age coming. And that time, the axial age was such a violent, warring time. And it seems like we're here now in a very violent, warring time as well. And my question is, how does one have a cosmic... Is there a necessity for this transcendence with violence? I mean, what is the correlation? What is that relationship? Yeah. And how does one have a cosmic relationship with the violence?
Well, of course, like Gautama Buddha and Jesus and Confucius and Socrates were not, to our knowledge, a particularly violent people. But the violence of those eras was part of the environment within which the birth of the axial era took place, and it tended to take place not at the centers of the great empires, but on the outskirts. You know, the outskirts of the Roman Empire. You know, or the and. Birth, particularly human birth, with our large brains and our bipedal erect posture and the size of the pelvis and the pain that is involved in childbirth, means that birth in most cases is experienced for the infant in particular, as having a certain violence. That's what the perinatal psychology has kind of opened up, and integrating that level of intense experience of both being a victim and also having tremendous rage as you're being, you know, you can't breathe, the umbilical cord is being squeezed, the oxygen's not coming in, the being that you thought was, like, thought in quotes, was this, you know, you were the loving, beloved center of its cosmos, and now you're being expelled by that being ruthlessly by these powerful forces, and et cetera. Birth seems to involve a kind of sacrifice of the old universe in order for the new one to be born. And part of our, I mean, I think we're working very hard in different disciplines and medical practices and so forth to recover a lot of the ways in which birth could be less violent. I think it's part of, anyway, that's a whole other subject. But I'm wanting to show you the parallel between the fact that birth of something, of a new being, involves the destruction of the old matrix. And violent energies get activated. It's not something I'm comfortable with. One thing I'd like to point out is that it seems that a lot of what's behind kind of fundamentalist terrorism, on the one hand, it can reflect the sense of having been shamed, and there's a lot of, you know, I think particularly in a lot of the Islamic, Islamist radical movements, there's a lot of shame that is being ragefully expressed and discharged after having been, how it's been treated by the modern West, etc., Christianity, Crusades, and so forth. But there's another level to it, and that is that fundamentalists have had very often an experience of the numinous, and it comes in a certain way. And that particular way, whether it was reading the Quran or getting inspired by a passage in the Bible or hearing a preacher, whatever form it takes, that sense of the numinous is so, of the sacred, is so precious. It's so much more important than anything else that's happened in that person's life, and it seems to redeem their life in a certain way, that one holds on to that for dear life, because that's your connection to the axial transcendent, or that's your connection to meaning, to your living a meaningful life, to you having an identity that's worthwhile. And if that experience has a, for many reasons, if it's limited to that, then anything that seems to threaten that is demonic. It's like I'll kill you rather than have God or the sacred or Allah or whatever profaned or threatened by you. I'll sacrifice my own life rather than have that, you know, et cetera. So there is, if we think of the collective psyche of the whole human race right now as one psyche, what is being said by these violent voices? And it has something to do with we need to hold on to the sacred against the onslaught of a disenchanting secular juggernaut that is trying to take over the world and eliminate a higher meaning. So there's some of there's a cry, a cri de coeur on behalf of the sacred, mixed up with the shadow of sadistic, aggressive rage and vengeance and so forth. But the violence, it's in the cosmos, it's in nature. The big extinctions of species across the globe have happened before Homo sapiens or anything like hominins ever existed. It's part of the mystery of the whole. I can't say I'm comfortable with that personally, but I'd like to see the lion and the lamb all lay down together in the long run, and perhaps that happens in some other dimension of being. But we do live in a cosmos where the opposites, including the most intense violence and the most tender love, exist in some peculiar marriage of opposites. It's a mystery. One more, I think, and then we...
If humanity is ever able to make the cultural changes to move back to sort of revitalized first circle over there and embrace the spirituality that includes other beings, what do you think would be the most important sort of cultural transformation or the fountainhead of that change? Is it like a new religion? Is it a revitalized core to other religions? Is it the visions of poets and artists? Is
yes,
it social
yeah.
and political changes? Is there a dynamic, a YouTube video that goes viral?
Yeah, you're right. People used to think it was going to be LSD, you know, or MDMA, you know. Probably all of the things that you mentioned will be part of it, and things that we don't know about yet can emerge. The collective psyche goes through spontaneous transmutations. Sometimes very rapidly, in the same way that we as individuals sometimes can go through quite in the fullness of time, at the right hour, at the Kairos moment, as Jung called that, you know, that the right moment for a metamorphosis of the gods, of the fundamental symbols and principles. Something is going to have to shift in our symbol systems. Which inform and are expressive of our psyche, which is the collective psyche, but which is also therefore the anima mundi, the cosmic psyche in some sense, and that's always evolving and changing, and sometimes the change can happen very rapidly, and when it happens, everything shifts. The technology shifts, the epistemologies shift, the social structures shift. The art, the poetry, the music. Boy, music plays a huge role in affecting, you know, the collective mood of a civilization. You couldn't understand the revolution of the '60s without the music, and if nobody knew what the music was, they would miss, like, that was almost at the essence of what happened, even though many other things were happening. But it was carried. And the people, the men and women who were at the front of the civil rights movement, and they'd have their three-hour meetings at night, getting ready for the next confrontation with the police in the South. This is the early '60s. I was hearing one of the people who were part of the. They said, of those 3 hours, 1 hour was talking. Preparing for, you know, the strategies, the nonviolent approach, et cetera. The other 2 hours, this is late at night after they'd all worked everything, the other 2 hours were singing. And it was absolutely essential to it. Probably every, I think the arts are, in some ways, the arts and the religion, the science, they were all one together here. And they get much more differentiated with the modern. And I think right now it's interesting with science, religion, and philosophy having lost their sovereignty at the top of the culture's authority in their own way. It's the arts that have a certain authority right now. We listen to what great poets, musicians, they're bringing epiphanies. People used to listen to Bob Dylan in between 1964 and 69 the way one would have listened to a prophet in ancient Israel. Like, what's he saying? There's something deep there. And there was something deep there. And he was seeing stuff that was, he himself felt like something's coming. I didn't even know everything that I was saying, but he was a vessel. So the imagination, the creative artistic imagination, is a central part of what I think could play a crucial role in our transformation. Let me just finish with a note about, thank you for that thought and question. Let me just say something about heroic communities. This transformation we can't go through on, we can't do it as individuals. If there is one task of our time, it's to develop a moral and imaginative vision for the future of our planetary culture that is connected to the cosmos itself. And heroic communities, I'm using the word heroic the way Charles Taylor talks about, it's that where the individual who has a vision of a higher good and dimension of the good than the rest of the society and helps to transform that society through that vision. And we've had a focus in the West on individuals doing that, the prophet, the philosopher, Socrates, etc. But in our postmodern era, where the entire horizon of meaning has been erased, and we're in this kind of state of free-falling, we are fundamentally in a state of seeking in a world that doesn't have any pre-given structures of meaning and purpose embodied in the cosmos that are publicly accessible and that are embodied in the structures of the society. We're all by necessity on a quest. And in that sense, what's really emerged, I think, in our time is how crucial it is for communities to be heroic. Because if you live in a vast cosmological void, you cannot create and sustain a re-enchanted cosmology on your own. You know, like the Atlas archetype, carrying it, you know, by yourself. We absolutely need to have communities that can together sustain the enormous act of the spiritual and intellectual and empathic imagination that can vivify and co-creatively participate in the reawakening of a meaningful universe. Only a community can hold space for something like that, and particularly not only because to be able to hold the ideas and discuss them and vivify them in that way, but just emotionally and spiritually, the communities hold space because the journey is a difficult one and a perilous one individually that we have to go through. And we need each other to hold space as we go through these rites of passage, these initiations, these spontaneous descents and transformations. So in one way, we have to overcome this individual, heroic, lone cowboy kind of mentality that is built into our society's value system. But we also need it. But we need it because we do need to hold a vision of the good that clearly our mainstream disenchanted society is not holding. But we need to do that in communities. And I think a lot of it comes down to the depth of initiation of that a community can hold space for its individuals to go through, so that there's an individual. It's not, and it has to be permeable to the whole, so that it's not a cult. It has to be able to keep taking in the larger whole and the vocabulary and the realities of the larger society. It's also got to hold space for individual, not just a, you know, there's not just one way. Every one of us is a way, and we need them all. Okay, well, that's a long night. You guys have been incredibly patient. Thanks a lot.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. All rights reserved. No copying, please.